Welcome everybody here for the JJPOC meeting. I am glad to see everybody. I am going to assume that I'm going to have a companion sooner or later in the meeting. I think maybe there's just something in standing in place. Let's see, let me get the agenda out. I'd like to ask for, has everybody read the minutes and ask for a motion to accept the minutes? They've been moved. Seconded. Are there any objections or corrections? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Okay, going right on to Mr. Carbone.
Good afternoon. So we have a full agenda this afternoon for the JPOC. First, we'll have an update on the CJTS closure plan report, which was officially issued earlier this week and has been sent out to members of the JPOC. And DCF administrators are here to do that. Secondly, today, we have an update on the strategic goals that were adopted by JPOC in June of 2015. This is the increase in diversion, decrease in recidivism and incarceration. And so today you get your first report on where we stand 15 months later after adopting them. We have an update from three of the work groups. And finally, we have a very exemplary project to bring to the attention of JPOC, one that I think really speaks to progress and reform, and it concerns the State Department of Education and the judicial branch.
All right, so going right on to the final report for CJTS closure.
And actually, I'm going to ask Linda Dixon if she wishes to speak to that, and then the committee members can make any comments or questions.
Sure. Hi, I'm Linda Dixon from DCF. So the plan was updated. We incorporated feedback from the JJPOC work group chairs. We also incorporated feedback from several national experts into the plan. You'll find more detail in there. There are cost estimates for changing the service array. We talk about bringing in an architect for getting some cost analysis done on making renovations to the existing site. We're continuing to look at state properties. We've actually working with our Georgetown consultants now to have a focus group with private providers on how to serve this population in the community in the future. So we've done a lot of different things, and I think we were responsive to the feedback of the group. The plan is considerably more detailed.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Could I let me ask, for all of our sakes who haven't read it, can you tell us what's the difference between the last report and this report?
I think you'll find more information on cost report, community services, size of services that we need to expand. There's also talk about different sites that the state will visit as well.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Next we have
the report on strategic goals. And actually this is one that I'm pretty excited to present to you, because when we came to you in June of 2015 and we recommended that the committee adopt three goals, some people thought the goals were too lofty and perhaps not realizable. Other people, including Secretary Barnes, thought maybe they were not as ambitious as we could have made them. So our data work group has been very busy in the last several weeks collecting data on all three of the goals: reduction in incarceration, in recidivism, and an increase in diversion. And so today, this is the first time we'll be reporting to you as to where we are since those goals were adopted by JPOC more than a year and 3 months ago. So I'm going to turn it over to Brian Hill, the co-chair of the data work group, and I think you have here as well people from the agencies that may be able to support some of the data that it includes.
Good afternoon. Brian Hill from the Connecticut Judicial Branch Court Support Services Division. I'm here on behalf of the cross-agency data sharing work group and my co-chair, Undersecretary Natalie Wagner. We have a series of measures to present to you today in this presentation. I do want to kind of lay a little bit of a foundation to draw some distinctions and follow up a little bit on some questions that came up during last month's meeting. I do want to make sure that everybody can understand the distinction between this report, which is simply a report on the strategic goals that were adopted by this committee, and the various research projects that are ongoing by many different research partners. And so this is going to provide us with some very descriptive information about progress made toward those goals. The three studies from the University of New Haven, the one study from the Harvard Kennedy School, and the one study from the IMRP at Central Connecticut State University are going to provide the committee with a much deeper dive into the system, into the consumers of the juvenile justice system, the programs, and much more statistical analysis. So I wanted to make sure that this report today is separate and distinct from those ongoing research projects. And so with that, I want to remind the committee of the target goals. And so in June of 2015, there was a presentation to this committee that established the target goals for the JJPOC. And we set an end date, or this committee set an end date, of by June 30th, 2018 to achieve these goals. And there were a number of charts and data that were presented that helped us to describe whether or not we were going to make progress toward increasing the number of kids that were diverted from the system by 20%, decreasing the number of kids who are incarcerated by 30%, and decreasing the recidivism rate for kids who are already involved in the system by 10%. And in the 15 months since that report, there has been a tremendous amount of data development that has gone on within the state agencies and the municipalities who collect information on the juvenile review boards. And what we've done over the past several weeks is refine this report to make sure that we have consistency across measurement periods, we have consistency in definitions of how we're measuring our progress toward these goals. And so I hope that you will find the slides that are after this to be informative and clear so that everybody understands exactly how we're doing. So with that, the first strategic goal area that we'll talk about is diversion. And again, our goal was to increase the number of kids who were diverted from the juvenile justice system by 20%. And when this group last received an update, and we can consider this that was reported to you in June of 2015 as the baseline, there was information that was reported to you on juvenile delinquency referrals, and at the time, the most recent information that the committee was presented was from fiscal year 13-14, and there were 11,471 referrals to the juvenile court. And so I'd like to establish that as our baseline. That was what was presented to the group. We also had a measure in here that looked at referrals to the juvenile review boards. And the most recent year of information that was available at the time was from fiscal year 12-13, and there were 2,230 referrals to the juvenile review boards. So again, you'll see transition slides in this presentation that tell you what our goal is and what the baseline was 15 months ago when originally presented to this group.
Can I ask on the JRBs, are we taking the whole universe of JRBs or are we just doing specific ones?
So I will defer that question for further context to Erica Bromley in a moment, but we are looking at statewide. And that's probably the area where we've seen the greatest data development and where we may still see some great data development in the coming months. But there is an effort to try to describe the entire state's referrals to juvenile review boards, and that's probably the most difficult task that the group has. And Erica will certainly speak to some of those efforts. So the first slide that you see here, we have information now for fiscal year 14-15 and fiscal year 15-16. And what this shows you is that since the last report in June of 15 to this group, there's been a 15% decrease in delinquency referrals to the juvenile court. It went from 11,472 at the end of June, the year ending June 2014, to 9,813 in fiscal year 15-16. And so that's a 15% decrease just in the 15 months since you were last provided the baseline. There's been a 37% decrease in delinquency referrals over the past 12 years. And what we've tried to do in each one of these charts is remind the committee that in the midst of these, in some cases, very long trends that we have of data, we had the two obvious policy changes that went into effect on January 1st, 2010 and July 1st of 2012, and those were the Raise the Age initiatives. And I don't think I need to remind anybody on this committee that we had projections when we were talking about these issues 10 years ago that the size of the juvenile court was going to need to double. And in fact, we haven't seen that, and we are at the conclusion of the last full fiscal year, we're at the lowest number of referrals for delinquency matters to the juvenile court that we've seen in the last 12 years. The next area was examined, and again, Representative Walker, you asked about whether or not this represented the whole state or, I think as has been presented to this group in the past, a look at the big cities and everybody else. And that is, in fact, how it was presented to the committee back in June of 2015. You will see, and I want to be fully transparent to the committee here, that we do have some holes in this data. And I want to recognize the efforts of Erica Bromley. In the fiscal year 15-16, they made tremendous progress in data collection. We were not confident in the information that was collected that it was complete for fiscal year 13-14 and 14-15, and so you will see a break in the data there. We would like to emphasize that from this point moving forward, there is a higher level, a much higher level of confidence in this data. And so while you don't see a trend line here that might be indicative of more kids going to the juvenile review boards, I think, you know, Erica could probably provide a little bit more context for the activity that's going on in that area.
Thank you. Erica Bromley, Connecticut Youth Services Association. As Brian said, I think always starting with the good news is that for the first time in the history of the juvenile review board system, which has been around for 50-plus years, we finally have a standardized data collection tool that is being used statewide. This is also inclusive of the fully DCF-funded JRBs, and CYSA worked closely with DCF in order to create one tool that we could both utilize. So we have that, and we'll be able to report and hope to report soon in the future a lot more comprehensive data that we can present to this group as well in terms of outcomes and referral sources and demographic breakdowns and all of those kinds of things that we are now gathering. The past year was the first year that the information was collected. We still have a few trickling in. We're missing a small chunk of the data for the last fiscal year. It was due a few weeks ago, so we're still receiving some, but this is the most up-to-date and accurate number, and as Brian said, we have the most confidence in this number. As far as the two missing years, the Juvenile Review Boards, as part of their Youth Service Bureau's report to the State Department of Education, and that report, those reports and those that data collection is due every 2 years. So there is some difficulty, and which will now be easier because of the new data collection system, but there was some difficulty in the off year gathering that data, which was one of the breaks in the data, as well as the transition over to the new data collection tool. So between those two things, that was the main reason why we didn't necessarily want to add those data points in, just because we were less confident about the total numbers.
Sorry. The other question that I would want to look at is taking the span from, let's say, 2011 to 2016 as we look at the data. I'd also like to put next to it the amount of funding that was provided during that time, because I know it's dramatically been reduced. And so I think that's critical for us when in looking, you know, at that, because I happen to be as Mr. Carino is, I happen to be a big fan of JRBs. So I think it's important for us to understand how much effort we're getting out of this from very little dollars. Thank you.
Erica, you do have confidence, though, that the 12-13 number and the 15-16 number are comparable, given that there were changes that happened between them? I mean, is it reasonable for us to conclude that we've had over the last 5 to 10 years, significant increase, but that it has been relatively stable for a couple years? I mean, that's the conclusion I want to draw, but I want to make sure that you think that that's supported by the data, given the difficulties in getting uniform data.
It's a hard question to answer. You know, as we said, we're confident in this number, which will also go up once we get all the missing data in. So that 15-16 number will increase, which will turn the trend line up a little bit. As far as the 12-13, that's the data that we had gathered based on just people reporting numbers. So the data collection was a little bit different. Still, you know, that's what was reported to the State Department of Education and creating the report to the legislature for every other year that SDE does. So I think there's certainly been an increase in JRB usage and in new ones being created. So I think that as we move along, we'll really see that. Definitely confident in 15-16. Not to say I'm not confident in the 12-13 data. It's just a different collection process. Right.
So in summary, with the diversion group, this committee had set some targets. In addition to the percentages, we utilized the baseline numbers, and this committee had set some targets for referrals to the juvenile court based on the 11,472 that the committee saw during the last report, a 20% decrease in referrals to court. Keep in mind that referrals to court is kind of the inverse of diversion, and so it's a proxy for diversion. But 9,178 was the target that was set by June 30th of 2018. And just as a kind of in summary here, there were 9,813. So there has been really excellent progress made in just just a short period of time. With the juvenile review boards, we have recalibrated that target based on the information that we collected in 15-16. And so in speaking with Erica, she felt reasonably confident that given better data collection efforts, more JRBs, and hopefully more referrals, that reestablishing that target of more kids, 20% more kids going to the juvenile review boards was in fact reasonable. Moving on to incarceration, and I think the committee will see some really terrific trends in this area. The goal was to decrease the number of kids who are incarcerated by 30%. And we take a look at a few different areas of the system here. We're looking at juvenile detention centers, and for the periods that we're looking at, that encompasses our two state centers, one in Bridgeport and one in Hartford. Also looking at the CJTS population and The department reports each and every time this committee meets on the census, I think that people would not be surprised that is going down. And then also we have partnered with the Department of Correction to collect information on the Manson Youth Institution. And so you can see the numbers that were presented to the committee during the last report. And if we start with our state-run juvenile detention centers, and looking at number of admissions, and so just for a point of clarification here, we're counting admissions here. A child can be admitted multiple times throughout a 12-month period, and so this is counting each admission. It's important that we continue to count it that way and that we establish our baseline and then report on the trends using that exact same definition, and so that's what you're seeing on this slide. You can see that just since the 2015 report, so the last time you saw this information, there's been a 27% decrease in admissions to juvenile detention. And over the past 11 years, that's gone down from a high of 2,916 in fiscal year 06, which represents a 42% decrease in the number of admissions to juvenile detention. For a little further context, there are 48 juveniles in detention as of this morning. A little more information that might be of interest to the committee, though not up on the slide. We often look at average daily population. In 2005, the average daily population was 138. In thus far in 2016, our average daily population is 54. So I think that this gives us every reason to celebrate some really good achievements here with juvenile detention admissions. Moving along to the training school administered by the Department of Children and Families, we're looking at a very similar trend here. We can see that since the last time this committee was apprised of the admissions to CJTS, there's been a 38% decrease and a 40% decrease over the longer period of time. And so, you know, I think that this shows the same encouraging trends toward fewer kids being in locked facilities. We're very happy about this trend as well. Moving along to the adult secure facility portion of our possible placements for juvenile justice kids. This chart looks at the Department of Corrections Manson Youth Institution and want to make sure that everybody's clear that that is for males. And this particular trend looks at males who are under the age of 18. And this is admissions for both sentenced juveniles and pretrial juveniles from fiscal year 07 through 16. And just since the last report, we've gone down 28%. And, this is the most dramatic decrease over the longer period of time. There were 1,618 such individuals in fiscal year 2007 and just 111 during the most recent fiscal year, a 93% decrease.
Can I go back to the state-run juvenile detention centers with the decreases?
Certainly.
Can you give me, or can somebody from CSSD give me a reason why they feel that this trend is going down, or can you give it to me? You are from CSSD, too. Huh?
I am. I think that there's a variety of reasons, and I would ask my colleagues and the leadership from the branch to jump in if there's further context. But I think it's greater use of alternatives. It's fewer kids coming to the juvenile court. So, you know, all of these charts that we're sharing with you kind of fit together chronologically of a kid's experience in the juvenile justice system. And, you know, so if you have fewer kids coming into the court, you have fewer kids who are exposed to the possibility of being in secure detention. And I think that, the entire system has really emphasized for many years that the use of detention, be as minimal as possible.
I'm not going to hesitate to just give some credit to Judge Conway, who's here, and Judge Carroll, because I think a lot of this really has to do with the leadership and the direction. And I don't think it happens by accident. I think it happens because policies and practices and training are all geared toward making the use of detention the absolute option of last resort. And we have the kind of leadership that's really supporting the goals of the JJPOC.
Steve?
I couldn't agree with Bill more. That's absolutely where it starts. And then I think there's just a number of things that come into play. Improved programming, mm-hmm. which lead to a reduction in recidivism, better juvenile probation officer skill, motivational interviewing, family engagement. I think we've done a lot of good work in quality assurance in our programs to make sure the fidelity of the model is delivered in the way it's intended to, and with that comes these kinds of results. It's the diversionary opportunity. I think it's the work with the state's attorneys and the public defenders and our partners, in the private sector. It's really a conglomerate effort.
Fran?
Sorry. Frank Carino from the Chief State's Attorney's Office. While I agree with what everybody said so far, also keep in mind that around 2012, the law changed, requiring a court order to put anybody in detention. Mm-hmm. That kind of acts as a deterrent for the police to put a kid in detention. And also the New Haven Detention Center was closed right around that same time, leaving only centers in Hartford and Bridgeport, which again, for a police department to transport a kid to detention, it required considerably more effort as a result. So I think those two also factored into the reduction.
And I also think that the police training and the way they approach juveniles was also worked into this equation a lot, because I know we worked on that also. Yes, Mr. Secretary.
I have a couple quick data questions. First of all, thank you, and I certainly don't. I'm going to ask some questions because I want to make sure I understand this, but it doesn't mean I don't think these are all wonderful results, because they clearly are. These are all compared to since the 2015 report, which is when we all sat around here and came up with these targets. But I realized that their different numbers were available at that time, so that the 27% decrease in juvenile detention center admissions is a two-year change, mm-hmm. whereas is a two-year change, right? Whereas the change... Are they all two-year changes?
So due to the timing of the report in June of 2015, that was one of the efforts that we tried to do here. You didn't have a full fiscal year's worth of information. So where information was presented at the fiscal year level, in June of 2015, we would have been reporting on the fiscal year ending in 2014. So Secretary Barnes, you're correct. These would be two-year.
But not the CJTS, which is a one-year total.
Right, which...
It's a one-year. If my math is right, 38% represents a drop between 226 and 140. It would be significantly higher.
Yep.
Decline
and
than
it's
a two-year total.
Indeed, yes. And then it's possible that that was the number that was submitted and discussed at the 2015 report.
It's fine. I get that. But I also think that, if we're going to start monitoring these things going forward, we should try to make them all a little bit more uniform in terms of, periods. I understand that there's a little noise at the beginning. The other thing that I would suggest that we, as we go forward in looking at these, is that they're all relative. So if I go back a page, I see that the number of delinquency referrals to the juvenile court has gone down. That's the universe from which young people
right.
will be either submitted to the juvenile detention center or ultimately to CJTS. So perhaps identifying those on some measure as a rate against the number of original arrests will maybe show some additional information to us. I think we can all get the gist here, but especially as we look at these over longer periods of time and we're trying to understand how policy initiatives have been effective at keeping people out of detention, keeping people out of post-sentence incarceration or any other stage, I think that may be a helpful way to refine some of this data. But this is a great start on certainly on this incarceration measure. We got to set new targets. We have met the targets, so we need to have new ones, because these won't do for 17-18 in my mind.
So Secretary Barnes, just in answer to the point you made, I recall that we did look at the rate of the use of detention in Connecticut versus some other locations. In fact, in one of the courses I teach, there's the national figure that it's 20 to 25% nationally of all kids who come into juvenile courts make their way into a detention center. In Connecticut, I believe it's around 10%, something in that range, 10, 12%. I believe we're about half the national average in terms of our use of detention. Now, that will change even more so in the future, because starting in January, there's some new criteria that goes into effect with the law that passed in the last session, the JJPOC implementation bill, and it will actually reduce the criteria for admission
to detention
from 7 criteria down to 3 or 4, but the criteria that will no longer apply, when we looked at that in the work group, it would have actually meant that about half the kids last year would not have been admissible into detention. So that should have a further impact of reducing our numbers in detention beginning in January. And I know the branch is getting ready for that change.
Abby?
Thank you, Abby Anderson, Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. Just a couple quick things. I want to echo what everybody said about all the great work being done by the judicial branch, by DCF, obviously, with its policy and practice changes. I thought the point that you just made, Secretary Barnes, about looking at rate is incredibly important, and I think it's even more important when we start looking at the rate of how this is affecting kids by race and ethnicity, because I know in a lot of states, while the total number of kids incarcerated has gone down, it hasn't necessarily affected the disproportionate or the disparate impact. So it's great overall if we reduce the number of young people, and just by doing that, you should have fewer people of color as well. But I know just if we look at what has been happening in other states, you end up with it is a smaller pool, but an even higher concentration of kids of color. So I think that's just something we want to make sure we're looking at as well. And I know that's happening, but I just wanted to bring that up.
I just want to ask DCF if you can figure out, can you explain to us why your numbers have dropped so dramatically?
Sure. Bill Rosenbeck from CJTS. Sort of along the same lines, we get about 3 to 5% of the total youth served by CSSD. So as that number has gone down, so has our new commitments, which are primary feeder to CJTS, has also gone down. That, along with Commissioner Katz reviewing both congregate care and parole admissions and really making sure they meet the level of care prior to coming to CJTS, has also helped with that reduction of youth coming in. So it's those two are the primary factors for that.
Okay. And our newest member from DOC, I'm sure she'll be glad to find out for us. No? Maybe?
The Raise the Age legislation.
Could do me a favor. Yeah.
The Raise the Age legislation, my Mary off-the-cuff response.
Okay. Do me a favor, state your name.
Mary Lansing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks.
So we finished here with the male population in DOC. We have a chart here for the females at the York Correctional Institution. I do want to point out to the committee that this was not information that was presented in 2015, so this is new information to the committee. And again, this is looking at under age 18 sentenced and pretrial admissions from 2007 to 2016. And, you know, when the numbers get down to 4 and 7 in the last 3 years, you know, we have, you know, there's some pretty obvious trends there. So this was a good lead-in by Secretary Barnes here to where we stand relative to the target numbers that were established last year. In June of 2015, the committee established a target number of 1,868 admissions by fiscal year 18. We have, in fact, eclipsed that already significantly. The same can be said for admissions to CJTS. And the Manson Youth Institution, the target number that was established for 2018 was 102, and we are obviously making great progress toward that at 111 in the last period. Moving on to our last strategic goal area is looking at recidivism. And I'm excited to report that we have a more complete picture of recidivism on children who are involved in the juvenile justice system. And the goal of the committee is to reduce recidivism by 10% over the 3 years that followed last year's meeting. Last year's meeting, there were 2 points that were presented to the committee. One was on adjudicated youth who were placed on probation in calendar year 2012 and followed for 24 months after that placement on probation. And the rate of rearrest for those youth was 60%, and that's what was presented to the committee last year. There was also a figure that was presented to the committee that was part of the Office of Policy and Management's annual recidivism study. They looked at a cohort of under 18 youth who were released from the Department of Correction in calendar year 2011. And in that study, it indicated that 73% of those kids were rearrested within 24 months. I want to provide a couple of cautions about this information and clarifications. And so I first want to point out that what you're seeing here in the subsequent slides is looking at the recidivism measure of rearrest. And this committee last year established a definition of recidivism to include rearrest, reconviction, and reincarceration. And the cross-agency data sharing work group, for simplicity's sake and for consistency from last year's report, chose to just report on rearrest rates. We have had discussions with the various groups that are conducting the studies, and the more comprehensive measure of recidivism will definitely be included in those reports. And I would argue that it's most appropriate for all of those measures to be included where there is a much deeper statistical analysis that can be presented. So what you're seeing here today is a 24-month rearrest rate. My caution to the group is that the information that's presented in this section shouldn't lead people to a causal explanation. So it shouldn't, we can't draw the conclusion that because a child was in a particular status, be it on probation or in the training school or in the Department of Correction, that's the reason that they recidivated. This is just purely descriptive information that describes the patterns of recidivism that happened in the 24 months following their status. This information is also not presented with risk level in mind. And there's going to be some really great analysis in each of the research studies that takes risk level into account. And so those are just some caveats to the information that I wanted to point out to the group. The first population that is examined was presented to the group last year. This is looking at cohorts of juveniles who start probation or supervision by calendar year, from calendar year 2005 to calendar year 2014. And we've chosen a little bit different way to present this information. So for example, if we take the 2009 cohort, right in the middle of our chart there, you'll see a number that's under 2009 and it says 2038 kids. That's the number of kids that were measured in that year's cohort. We then took that cohort and looked out exactly 24 months from each of those kids' start date on probation or supervision and looked for incidences of arrest in the or referral to the juvenile court for a delinquency matter or arrest in the adult court if their age dictated that they were handled in the adult court. And what we see here is that that group had a rearrest rate of 65%. And so that's just kind of a quick primer on how to look at the information as it's presented here. In looking at the trend overall, you can see that for many years it bounced around between 64 and 66%. And in recent years, we've seen small but consistent reductions in rearrest rates for each of the cohorts. I will point out that the 2014 cohort on your chart represents only 6 months of kids who started probation in 2014, and that's just simply a matter of timing in that we don't have a full 24 months for all of the kids who started in 2014. This represents a 7% reduction since this group last saw this information, and a 15% decrease over the past 10 years.
So if I look at this and I say, now we're working with the population that's the hardest to serve, we have had some reductions, but not to the level that we want in the recidivism rate. And I guess my thought is, are we looking at how we serve the population to maybe change some of the ways we do it because of the impact that we need to achieve in this? So I'm going to ask, are we doing that?
And I would say the answer to your question is yes. And remember, the goal of 10% was by June 30th of 2018.
Yes, but we've achieved it, and we've surpassed it in other areas, so I would assume that we would like to have the same.
But I mean, I think we're moving steadily toward it, but I think your question is a larger question. What are we doing to assure that we're going to continue down this path? And the bill, the JPOC bill, and one of the recommendations from the Recidivism Committee was to put in legislation really the frameworks for recidivism reduction that we were taught really by Dr. Latessa when he came in to speak to us last February. And that requires all of the agencies, judicial, DCF, to assure that those frameworks are in place, not just in the public agencies, but in every contract. And that is now all going into effect. So I think really that's going to give us the kind of assurances that we need. And what are those frameworks? It's the validated assessments. It's the training and motivational interviewing. It's the evidence-based programming. It's targeting the strengths of people as much as the deficits. It's the quality assurance on programs. It's the reporting, so we can continually measure our progress. So I'm hopeful that that framework, that structure, will keep us moving in the right direction here.
And I agree with you, and I think there was a group that went to Massachusetts, and one of the one things that I heard from many members who told me about it was the fact that everybody in Massachusetts, no matter which way you go, they all get the same training. They all get the same objectives and goals, whether it be private or public. And I think we should take a play from that and start to look at how we're going to support that concept.
I have a question just about the recidivism numbers. Have you looked at it regionally to see if there's a difference, for instance, with in the cities where it's monitored versus if they live somewhere else?
So that's a great question, and so I can speak specifically to the to this slide, which represents kids that are on probation. That is that's something that we look at during our normal operational performance reviews. We look at our 12 probation offices, and we can break this information down into those areas. And to answer your question, and it doesn't matter if you're looking at juveniles or adults, we do tend to see higher recidivism rates in the larger urban areas. And it is important to look at the information geographically by risk level, by race and ethnicity, by various other statuses. Yes.
Yes, Steve.
Steve Grant, Judicial. Follow up to the comments. We have moved to the frameworks model that Dr. Latessa presented, frankly, several years ago. Now I think it's a matter of refining the officer skill level, quality assuring that skill level, staying consistent with those applications. And just so the committee is aware, we do provide that very same training to the contracted providers as well.
Okay, moving along, very pleased to report to the committee some new information on the population of juveniles who were released from the training school in calendar years 2011, 12, 13, and half of 2014. This is utilizing the exact same methodology that I explained on the previous slide. You'll see underneath each year's the number of kids that are represented in these groups. You'll see that obviously there are fewer kids who are being released from the training school than there are kids placed on probation. And so while we were dealing with, in some cases, several thousand kids in the probation yearly cohorts, we're dealing with, you know, between 70 and 100 kids annually released from CJTS. I want to recognize the folks at the Department of Children and Families who conducted this analysis. It was really a collaborative effort between the judicial branch and the department to do some good work over the last several weeks since the committee last met. And I extend my appreciation to all of the folks that we worked with at the department for this information. Okay. And the last population that was examined was the Department of Corrections Manson Youth Institute institution. Under age 18, these were transferred youth who were released from the Department of Corrections. So these are kids who were under the age of 18 when they committed the crime and were transferred to the adult court and were incarcerated at Manson. And then followed them for the same 2 years that we followed the other cohorts. You'll see similar to the CJTS population, these are much smaller populations than the probation population. And the credit here goes to my colleague Mary Lansing and her colleagues at the Department of Correction. And this was also a joint effort between the Department of Correction and the Judicial Branch, and want to acknowledge that.
Just a quick data question. On these, they may be somewhat older, depending on the length of their sentence.
Yes.
So some of them could have gotten out at age 21, having served whatever sentence they served.
That's correct. This was not isolated to being released under the age of 18, but they could have been older. That's correct. And that's, we look at each kid individually and their release date.
Right. No, that's fine. I'm just trying to understand there's sort of an aggregate difference between this
yes.
relatively small group and the small group coming out of CJTS.
That's right.
In general, this group is probably a little older.
The age at release
during the period of recidivism, the 2 year period.
Yeah, the age at release, though I don't have that information, I would agree with you that the average age would be higher.
Thanks.
So for recidivism, there were.
I just had a quick question.
I'm sorry.
I think it's a really good question about the age. Is that something that can be pinned down?
Certainly, we can take a look at the age at release for both of the cohorts. If that's something that the committee would be interested in, we can certainly share that information. Because of the data development that's been done between the agencies, all of that information is available, and I think that's a great question.
The offense under 18.
Right.
This is based on offense date under 18 years old, not release date age.
No, but I definitely think there may be, I suspect, maybe I'm wrong, that there may be some variation in recidivism rates based on, whether or not you're 16 or 19, I hope.
Yes.
Well, it's important to also bear in mind that we also deal with the aging out. So, and it's somewhere in that 19, 20, 21-year-old age group that they reach a certain point in life where, you know, they're more mature, they have more responsibilities, they have more to lose if they commit new offenses, so some of it just naturally falls off after that point.
The committee established target goals similar to the other strategic goal areas to decrease recidivism by 10% by June 30th of 2018. Target rate for adjudicated youth on probation was 54%. For the group that started probation in the first half of 2014, we saw a 56% recidivism rate. So, again, small incremental reductions heading in the right direction. For the group that was released from DOC in the first 6 months of 2014, their rearrest rate was 65%, which is, in fact, lower than the target rate that was established last year by the committee. We have not established a target rate since this is the first year that we're seeing the CJTS recidivism rate. So, in summary, I really want to highlight that there's been positive progress made in all three strategic goal areas. There's been a tremendous amount of data development that has gone on in the past 15 months. I suspect that there will be even greater advances in data development as we've learned a lot from the process of this analysis, but also sharing of data across agencies with the different research institutions. That data development starts with the information technology departments at the state agencies and the data collection efforts that Erica spoke about before, and certainly want to recognize the folks in the IT departments of all the agencies. Target numbers do need to be established for females in congregate care. We looked at the females at the York Correctional Institution. Obviously, there are no females at Pueblo since that facility has been closed, but the committee may wish to consider establishing some goals for females in congregate care and, as I just mentioned, recidivism rates for committed youth.
So I'm really pleased with the numbers that were presented today. And I recall, Representative Walker, a conversation with you when we first decided to go for the strategic goals, and your advice was keep it simple. Let's have overarching goals that really tell us whether or not the rest of the system is doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is how we arrived at diversion, incarceration, and recidivism. And when we set the numbers, we really wanted to set them at a more achievable level. And it looks to me like we're ahead of where we should be 1 year and 3 months later in every one of these categories, and that might be cause for us to, at some point in the near future, begin to review the goals and see whether or not they are still operable or whether they should be revised and made more ambitious. And I think, Rep. Secretary Barnes, that's one of the comments I recall you made when this was first presented. So this is very encouraging. And, you know, I'm a strong believer that if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. And so this is some basic data that we're now getting to see. And my conclusion is it shows us that we're going in the right direction.
I want to compliment everybody that participated in this because, as you said, Bill, now we can actually start to evaluate what we're doing and how we're doing it. And it's not making a criticism. It's just trying to figure out, should we go left or should we go right? And who are we targeting? And are we targeting the right services for that population now that we're drilling down into the numbers? So those are things that this is great. I love data, and I love to see and understand what the data is telling us, so that we can really share with everybody what's going on and how well we are doing what we're supposed to be doing. The one thing I think we would like to get is some of the things that we were talking about. I think we were talking about the racial breakdown. I would like to know the budgets during those periods of time so that we can see what, you know, how our dollars are going. Because I think all of those have to be part of the conversation for us to figure out which way we're going with what we hope to achieve. And I do think that we need to challenge the goals and make some adjustments. I think you guys are doing a great job, and I thank you for all the work that everybody's doing. And it's hard. It's really hard to see, but it's good because now we understand exactly where we're going, and I thank you for that. Thank you, Brian. Yes.
Brian, how does, particularly on the recidivism, how does our Connecticut rates compare nationwide? Because when I look at this, it doesn't seem to matter whether you're on probation, committed to DCF, or sent to Manson. We're still talking over half the kids that go through the system get involved again. Is that consistent with around the country?
So, Attorney Carino, I wish I could provide a simple yes-no answer to your question. Unfortunately, I can't. There really is no published national recidivism rate for different populations, and I think one of the biggest reasons why is that many states don't have statewide systems, and so we're talking about municipalities or counties that administer these systems. But maybe even more importantly, the populations of the kids who are in each of these statuses is different from state to state. And so if we looked at a state that was perhaps more reliant on congregate care, and so there are some states in the United States that rely and send thousands of kids to congregate care facilities. If we looked at their recidivism rates, they may have a much broader spectrum of risk of kids. They may include lower-risk kids and medium-risk kids. And our populations in congregate care and in the Department of Correction tend to be very small. And, I think it's understood that those are likely our highest risk kids. And so comparing across even research studies without the controls for risk level is not easily done. I think, from my experience in looking at the literature, recidivism rates for kids and youth are high. I think that, there's measurement differences across state. Are they looking at rearrest? Are they looking at conviction? Do states have wide diversionary programs available? So I wish I could give you an answer, but that's my best that I can do.
Martha?
Yeah, looking at the recidivism rates, in particular, I guess the question that I have is, they're based upon the array of community supports that are in the community at the time. And so how would the cuts that just happened in the last year to a lot of the community supervision type of programs, lack of substance abuse, et cetera, affect in the future going forward the recidivism rate? And can we really, have some confidence that it's going to stay in a decrease while we're cutting the community supports?
Well, I think the answer is we don't know that yet, because this period really takes us through June 30th. In order to look at the two years out, we had to go back to 2014. So we don't know the answer to the question, but I suppose as we're monitoring this from here on out, we'll be able to look at it from that standpoint.
Thank you. Abby?
Abby Anderson, Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. Just one other point I wanted to draw, I think, is we in Connecticut hold ourselves to a very high standard, right, that we measure recidivism based on rearrest, right? And I know there was talk at some point about looking as well at those additional measures. So rearrest and then, was that nollied or not? Or, did you go back to detention? Did you actually get reconvicted or re-adjudicated? And I just wonder how interesting that would be. I don't think this is going to be a really controversial thing to say, but, we've seen, especially nationally in the past couple of years, the color of your skin can have a huge effect on whether or not you're stopped by the police, regardless of whether or not you've had recidivism or you've been in the system. So sometimes that rearrest might be a result of your geography or the color of your skin versus you're in trouble again or you're doing something criminal. That obviously this isn't something we would just be wondering in Connecticut, but I wonder how much what differences, if any, we would see in recidivism rates if we started to measure some of those deeper down. And I love that we hold ourselves to this high standard, and I think we should. Some of it, I wonder how much can we change within the system, and how much are some cultural issues that we need to also be working on, but that are outside sort of the purview of this Well, they're not outside the purview of this room, but maybe this conversation.
Secretary Barnes?
I agree with that, but I also, I want to make sure that we're thinking kind of rigorously about the system that we're talking about. The likelihood, the data that you just showed today tells me that the likelihood of you being incarcerated if you get arrested as a juvenile is lower today than it was 2 years ago. Not only are fewer getting arrested, but of those who get arrested, fewer of them are being incarcerated. So so if you're going to use an incarceration standard on recidivism, you know, it's going to be going down because people are less likely to be incarcerated overall. So if you're Bill Rosenbeck and you're trying to think, how do I run my programs to help people, to prevent people from coming back, which is really what a lot of this ought to be geared toward, or any of the other folks who are managing programs in the community or institutional, how do I run my programs to make them reduce recidivism? Maybe the rearrest is a better measure for that purpose, because it cuts out the whole issue of whether our other system-wide improvements are making progress. The data sets that we have on recidivism, can we then apply them to look at things like, we've talked about race and age, but even about, could we look at recidivism rates based on participation in categories or even individual programs? And do we have enough data to make that meaningful?
Yes, and so I'm glad you brought up that point, because the studies that UNH and Central and the Harvard Kennedy School, particularly the two state institutions that have all of the programmatic data and all the other variables that you talked about, they'll certainly be able to do that more rigorous statistical analysis, including all of those variables.
And I agree 100%. I think the only point I was trying to make, which clearly I didn't, was so that we know what the numbers tell us when they tell us that, right? So Bill Rosenbeck might be doing a fabulous job, and he has a high recidivism rate. It might not be because his program is working. It might be because, unfortunately, that kid lives in an area where the policing is over. So we might be trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist if we're not looking a little deeper. So I was seeing it as most as a both and, right? So, like, the programs might actually work, or they might not, but I'm not sure that by itself the rearrest number tells us everything we need to know.
Is it possible to break it down by urban versus suburban communities in the rearrest data?
Certainly, additional analysis are available. Like I said, we have both in the data that was provided to the researchers and in these data sets that were utilized, we have, a variety of information on each of the kids. I do want to point out that certainly don't want to preempt the findings of the studies, and because I know that they're going to be doing a lot of that analysis.
We don't want to slow down any of the studies. We just want to add to their wonderful product that they're going to be bringing to us.
Well, I can tell you that the studies, all the data that's been received at the University of New Haven is 10 years plus of data from state agencies. And it's your question about, can we look at recidivism in terms of risk level? Yes. Can we look at it in terms of program models? Yes. Can we look at it pre-raise the age, post-raise the age? All of that is part of the studies that you've approved, and hopefully at some point in early 17, we're going to start reporting to you on those studies. And Dr. Cooper is here today, and Dr. Coker, and they're working very hard. And this is a good chance for me to introduce Dr. David Meyer. He's our newest addition at the University of New Haven. He's head of our PhD program. But the reason he came today is he used to be a juvenile probation officer in Pennsylvania, and actually did his dissertation for his PhD on transfer of juveniles from juvenile courts to adult courts. So he has a sincere interest in the nature of the work that we're doing. And so welcome, Dr. Myers. Representative Walker.
I just want to point out that we have a very, very aggressive agenda that I don't think we're going to be able to complete. Just pointing that out.
Right. So what I wanted to suggest to you is, because at the last meeting, our friends from Department of Education and Judicial were here to present, and we had to put it off.
Mm-hmm.
If we can forego the work group updates with your permission and call them up to do their presentation, I think you're going to like what they have to say.
I was going to ask that.
Okay.
Thanks.
So let me introduce Kathy Foley-Guy from the Judicial Department and Ajit Gopalakrishnan from the Department of Education, Celia Seifert from the Judicial Branch. This is a demonstration project that really gets to the heart of sharing information among agencies, something that I know we've talked a lot about at JPOC. So it always occurred to me during my time in state government that if we know that one of the chief problems that kids face and the reason for getting them into the juvenile system is academic failure, well, how come we don't have more information in the courts about the academic progress of kids? How do we know about expulsions, about suspensions, about truancy? How do we know how they're doing in reading and other subjects? How can we better use the time of the probation department to get kids reconnected to schools? Because that's an important element of recidivism reduction. And really, that has now been achieved in the state through the branch and through the State Department of Education, and I believe also through the Department of Children and Families. So I think this is a very important initiative to bring to your attention. So I'll introduce, who's going to start? Ajit. He's got a very difficult to pronounce last name, but Gopalakrishnan.
Thank you, Bill. Good afternoon, Representative Walker, Representative Porter, Secretary Barnes, and others. My name is Ajit Gopalakrishnan. I'm the Chief Performance Officer at the Department of Education and joined by Kathy and Celia from Court Support Services Division. And that was a fabulous introduction. I had some things planned, but I think that pretty much says the gist of what this is about. But I just want to emphasize our commitment from education, and I think we have felt that, the mutual commitment to the success of these students and doing whatever it takes from our perspectives to make that happen. And Representative Walker, I have heard you talk about breaking down data barriers between agencies and why can't this be done. I'm here to say with our partners that, yes, it can be done. Sustained gentle pressure makes change.
Yes, we're always gentle here.
So it absolutely can be done. And we'll talk about how we're bringing that information to the people who need it on the front lines at CSSD. But I just want to make one point before I turn it over to Celia, which is that we have done this by the book. And by that I mean from protecting the confidentiality of the information that we are handling here. It absolutely has been done with all the proper protocols. Judicial and Department of Education have actually executed a memorandum of agreement that codifies this process between the two agencies, and that took sustained gentle pressure. And then we are also actually the parent and the guardian is involved in this process in that this information does not move until the parent and the guardian has consented to this transfer of education information. So
All of our attorneys are very happy to hear that.
I can hear them in my they're standing right there. So this has been done with those rules. So with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Celia, I think, right? Celia, who's going to actually walk you through this whole process that has been worked out between the two agencies.
Celia Seifert with the Judicial Branch Court Support Services Division. As has been mentioned, this project, the goal of this project was to electronically make available to available a child's school record to the juvenile probation officer, and that is what we accomplished. Because on June 22nd of this year, juvenile probation officers now have access to the school summary report that has been agreed upon. It meets a criteria. The criteria is very specific. First of all, the juvenile probation officer must have an open case. The second piece is that a release of information must be signed by the parent or guardian. And the third, the SACID number, which is a unique identifier for every child in the school, has been identified and added to our case management information system. The report allows juvenile probation officers to view historical data that is available through the State Department of Education data warehouse. The information from this warehouse is collected at certain intervals. I'll speak briefly about it its being more available over time. While this data may not reflect the most recent educational events, it does offer a simple and expedient way to retrieve the history of the child's education. The juvenile probation officers at this time do continue to need to send for immediate, most recent data, but over time, as the data warehouse gathers more information more quickly, that information will then become available to the juvenile probation officer more quickly. So how does this occur? Simply put, from an electronic version, the juvenile probation officer is sitting at her desk. She enters specific information into our case management information system. Every night, there's a batch job electronically that is sent to a black box, or in this case, a blue box. From that blue box, which is very secure, it is then processed in the evening by the State Department of Education warehouse. It collects all the information that is needed. It again sends it back to a secure box that is now on the judicial side, and that report is now made available electronically to the juvenile probation officer. How does this work for the juvenile probation officer? Currently, we have a case management information system that all information is collected on a juvenile. At this point in time, there is a tab called Education. The juvenile probation officer needs to collect the SACID number, which that you can see is added to the red box. They need to put in the date of the release of information, acknowledging that a release of information was collected on the juvenile for the juvenile from the parents. And until those two items are filled in, the icon at the bottom called School Summary Report will not be made available to them. Once those two pieces of data are added, the next day, that night, that data will be collected and made available to the juvenile probation officer. At any point in time that this case is closed out, that will immediately close out the ability of the juvenile probation officer to gather that information. As Ajit has said, we tried very hard to make use of technology to enforce the rules that were necessary. The report is broken into two sections. The most recent records that are available in the areas of attendance, special education, test scores, and disciplinary action. The second part of the report is more historical in nature, and it includes the school history, the attendance history, the special education history, test scores, and disciplinary action. Thank you. So that would be the second part. What this allows is, as fast as the data is available, each day we update the data through that same process that was discussed. And as time goes on, as that data becomes more available information will come more quickly to the juvenile probation officer. The challenges of the project, as mentioned by Ajit, was to get a group of people together that would have the availability of time and resources to accomplish the task. We had to get the business users from the education department, the warehouse staff, the juvenile probation officers, developers, and the Yale study who supported the project. The legal issues that we needed to overcome through an MOU, and then we wanted to be very aware of the security issues, and I believe that we've covered for those at this point in time. The current benefit is, now, probation officers, after the day they collect all this information, can have initial conversations about a historical view of not just one school, but two schools or three schools and all the information that's available, and it's a more global approach. The future benefit is obviously, as more real-time data becomes available, it will become available to the probation officers. And finally, well, thank you to all our partners. As we work through this project, it was very exciting, and it's well received. And I think I turn it over to Kathy for those comments.
Thank you, Kathy Folick, I have Judicial Branch. So I'll just talk a little bit more about the practical application of this report. One of the very frustrating things for a probation officer is not having access to a child's educational record. probation will request those records from school district. They need those records in order to complete their predispositional study for the court. And oftentimes the records do not come back until perhaps the study is done. So the study will be completed, the education section will be completed a lot based on child and parent report, but the probation officer won't have a full knowledge of what's happened to that child through the course of their educational history. So what you saw in the template was that you get to see the entire history of that child for every school that they've ever been enrolled in here in Connecticut. And what that allows for is not only quick, timely access to that information, but it allows the probation officer to look for patterns that they would want to discuss with the child, with the parent, with the school district. So if a child has been moving from school to school, then there should be a concern about the child being off track, being behind, because we know through research, moving schools puts you months, if not a year, behind in your educational process. Other patterns that probation is going to be thoughtful about and still be looking for are absences. Chronic absenteeism is very important, and they'll be able to see that on the report. It will give year by year the number of days that were missed and the percentage for that school year. And then lastly, it also gives all the information related to school discipline. And that information is not to for use against the child, but it's to understand what's been happening to the child in the academic environment. So if you have a child who's repeatedly been getting infractions for school policy violations or getting into fights, things like that, that will show up on the discipline report. They'll see what kind of sanction was administered by the school and if they were out of school any number of days, whether it was for suspension and expulsion. That will allow for questions to be asked about, well, what's going on for you at school? Have you been evaluated? You have a conversation with the parent about, has the child ever been evaluated? Has the parent ever asked for a PPT? And if the answer is a no, then the probation officer can help the family ask for a PPT and start that evaluation process. So though this report's only been in place for a short period of time, it went live over the summer, but obviously we're only about 7 weeks into the school year, staff are reporting that it is very helpful. Because one, it gives them very quick access to the information that they need. And if they want to know, you know, what was his attendance this past week or his current grades, they still have to communicate with the school, right? No one's saying there's no communication with the school, but this gives a very good historical summary of what's been going on. So probation officers have been able to identify children who've had these patterns of concern and to talk to the family about getting PPT scheduled. And so PPTs have been scheduled based on the use of this report. And that opens the door for evaluation and opens the door to services. Another example is that probation officers have noticed gaps in a child's educational plan. So they might have a child who receives special ed services and has an IEP, but they notice that there's gaps in that plan that aren't addressing specific things. And so again, they can talk to the parent, they can talk to the school, and have very targeted conversations about how to modify the educational plan for that child. And then lastly, it really affords the officer an opportunity to craft a much better report for the court in terms of customizing an educational plan that will be part of that child's probation. Under the Raise the Grade legislation that was passed several years ago, we do have a responsibility for developing very specific education plans for kids who are struggling with school attendance, struggling with behavior at school, or academically. And so this information can all be used to inform that planning process. And it's information in the past that we wouldn't routinely have access to in any kind of quick fashion. Unfortunately, some school districts aren't even able to identify the records for kids. So, you know, the data is going to be in the state's data warehouse, and we're able to extract that as long as we have permission, which is great. The other thing is, what it's also going to allow us to do internally as a system, as an organization, is to quality assure that the records are being received, and if there's problems with any of the quality of the information in the data warehouse, we can work with SGD around that. Some districts are more up to date with their data input than others, and that's important information for all of us to know. And it also helps CSSD look at the Raise the Grade plans that are being developed for kids. We'll be able to figure out which kids should have those plans, check to see do they have a plan, and is the plan consistent with the educational record. So, you know, we're very excited that this information is available and that we're going to be able to use it in a very timely fashion in order to provide much better services to the kids than we have been able to do to date. So we're very appreciative of the department's efforts and perseverance with us and getting all the legal issues worked out. We're very appreciative of Yale University, who received the grant to fund the development of the automated system. And we're very pleased with the technical staff and the IT staff at both agencies and the commitment that they put into this project.
Thank you, and I thank you all for all the work here. Jeet, good to see you again. A couple of questions that I have, and I'm sure Martha has a few too. A couple of questions that I have. Do you have access to PowerSchool?
We don't have access into that system. A probation mm-hmm. officer can work with the parent.
Okay.
The parent should have the PowerSchool number, the ID number, and can get into that portal. Probation officers can work with the parent individually mm-hmm. to look at what's in PowerSchool on a particular child.
At what point do you engage with the parent in this whole process? I'm not familiar with the probation officer. They automatically engage with the parent when the child is sent home?
So once the child is adjudicated or mm-hmm. assigned a statement of responsibility, then mm-hmm. that will prompt the probation officer to start their predispositional study, mm-hmm. and that's when they'll ask for the educational records, when they'll start inquiring about other issues. And from that point on, they'll get that information and use it, one, for the court report, and two, while they're working with the child and family, while the child's on probation, they'll use that information to provide supervision and access to services.
Okay. The reason why I ask that is in a couple of other studies that I've seen and things that I've looked at, we find that once the parent is engaged and informed and participate in, the child tends to react better because the parent understands a little bit better. Parents may not understand 504s. They may not understand homebound or those impacts and things like that because they did not understand the effects that they have with the child. So that's why I'm asking, when do we engage with the parent during the process so that we inform them as well as we get informed about the child and the history of the child, because I bet you a lot of parents don't even know that their children are not a lot, but some don't know that their children are on special education plans mm-hmm. and have they had a follow-up and are those things, you know, continuous. So, I mean, it goes both ways in that regard. And the other question I have is, how do the schools react to this?
I mean, I haven't heard reports of negative reactions. I think one of the benefits from schools, and hopefully they will say this over time, is that they'll get less requests for just copies and copies of records, right? Because the request now can be very targeted based on what's in that summary report, rather than asking for the whole educational file to be copied.
Martha?
Yeah.
I have a couple comments and some questions. First of all, I think it's a great beginning. And once you're getting the real time, that's when it's going to be the most useful, right? And so, you know, this issue of, so to me, one of the benefits of getting the historical data is to do child find violations. You're going to be able to pick up child find violations as a result of looking at the history. And I'm really hoping that the training with probation officers can really concentrate on that. The second point I'd make is if you're getting parental consent to use this system, it would be great to be able to get parental consent to get to use PowerSchool at the same time. And then the other question that I have really is, it's great that it was done with CSSD, but is it also going to be done with DCF? Because the kids are bouncing back and forth, and so you'd want DCF, once they went to a different system, to be able to get access to the same data.
I can answer the DCF question. We have been exchanging data with DCF for, I don't know, probably 3 years already, and they have access to some of our data through their link system on a real-time basis already. On a monthly basis, we also share with DCF. Again, in the case of DCF, it's a little different because in terms of confidentiality, FERPA, the federal law that governs confidentiality, was actually explicitly modified to allow education to release records to the child welfare agency in the state. So in addition to them being able to hit our data real time
DCS case workers through the link system. We also provide them with a monthly sort of file, for lack of a better word, that gives the sort of summary information for the 2,500 or so kids who are on their system in every month. And we have shared with them what we share with CSSD, because this is more comprehensive. And when we started with DCF, we didn't have our data warehouse up and running, but now we do. So we are actually going to be providing to DCF what we provide to CSSD on a monthly basis, in addition to their real-time access to data. I just want to clarify one other thing about PowerSchool. I'm not sure if you're thinking of PowerSchool at the school or district level. If a kid moves multiple districts, then there's not just one PowerSchool, and not everybody in the state uses PowerSchool. Yeah, it's not. It's about 60 to 70%. Like, about 130 districts use PowerSchool. A lot of them, the others don't. They use lots of other systems. So the warehouse, what it helps with is not only that it's a central place. Yes, it's not like immediate real time. It doesn't have all the data. We don't collect everything from districts, but it is a central place. If a kid moves six districts, you'd have to go to every district. Here, you actually get that history in one place, so that's the other advantage of it.
Okay, I'm going to ask an SDE question. So if I'm a child that is in DCF and I've been moved to multiple towns because I've been moved from family to family for a variety of reasons, what are you saying to me about my transcripts and everything?
They would go from school to from district to district.
So I don't keep up. And PowerSchool doesn't just report the district. But I thought they report the transcript of the child.
That data would exist within each school district.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying is that each district sends us the data.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the SACID, we are able to track that child's movement from one district to the other.
So when I do a purge in the system for Tony Walker's records, and let's say Tony Walker lived in Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven, if I'm in New Haven now and New Haven pulls up my SACID number, it's going to show all of the things that I've done in this state, correct?
I don't know, because we don't actually manage the local information system. So state doesn't manage PowerSchool for districts.
Mm-hmm.
Each district sends us the data for who they have at any point in time, and we collect data at different points in time, different data, and the warehouse actually pieces that together in a coherent story, so that the report that you see and hear is what we have pieced together based on the information that we have received over time from different districts.
Yes, go ahead.
It's really an answer to you as a parent on there. My daughter went from Hartford to Windsor. She had the same ID number in the parent.
Right. I know the ID, but if the information's not inputted by the system, then there's it's not there. But that's not for this. Go ahead. Yes.
So it's one sort of a response to that and then a comment. I think the concern with, I think this is good because it paints a picture of the child from which you can ask other questions. And depending on the point in time in the child's case, it can be used for different things. So I know, you know, Kathy said that most of the time this is going to be collected at the time the child has agreed to be adjudicated. But I also think releases get signed at different points in different cases based on the needs in the case. So if there was agreement by people earlier in the case, so the rights change at the point that the child's adjudicated. There's not a reason that if people agreed to it, this couldn't be done. I'm not sure that my folks knew this was happening already, and I think, I don't have, believe it or not, I don't have any issues with this. everyone's fine. But I think that people should know that it's out there so that, other people who are interacting, my office, who's the ones representing the kids, ought to be talking to the probation officer about it. I think the concern about PowerSchool is, depending on what you want it for, it's not always the most accurate picture. If you're just looking to see, on any given day, log in and see if the kid's flunking anything. Well, I can tell you as a parent of somebody, sometimes, depending on whether you believe your kid or not, that grade's right, that grade's not right, that grade's dependent on what the teacher put in or whether the homework got turned in. So I think this is a good place to land because you can go from there to ask other questions.
No, but the only thing I'm thinking about is if a child at some point or another gets incarcerated and then comes out and goes back and forth through the systems, are we looking at what the credits that the child needs to have in order to keep going towards their high school diploma? And that's more of what I was looking at, because I've heard from different foster children that they've had some problems because one school may say that you need a civics class, but that the district doesn't offer that civics class, so that ends up not getting addressed. So that's all I'm saying.
So I've heard that both from lawyers who represent child protection children and from people going through the delinquency system. This will get us there. So this will at least give the professionals working with those kids the roadmap of where the child has been, so that you can go piece it together for them, where before it would have been impossible, other than by listening to sort of self-report and what you piece together from people, to get an accurate map of where the child had gone. So I think you're going to find that this will help all of those folks that are trying to help those young people put their educational records together.
Thank you, everybody. This is a great start, and it's so nice to see data coming in another direction. So thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Mr. Carbone, my team has abandoned me because everybody said it's 3:30.
Right.
So I'm going to say that we will continue at the next meeting.
So just note the date is November 17th.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Everybody have a great and safe way.